Say, you mind if I play you a little something real quick?
I don't know. The last time you went on an impulse, you embarrassed the shit out of me.
Look, this'll be easy. I promise. Watch.
Okay, if you're a black woman of a certain age, then you already know. That was Lorenz Tate as Darius Lovehall, kicking it to Nia Long's character, Nina Mosley, in 1997's Love Jones. Now, a lot of us have been revisiting Love Jones in recent weeks, thanks to its release on Netflix this month. Now, the film was an artistic intervention in the 1990s, a hard departure from the Boys in the Hood, New Jack City version of black urban life. It offered us a wholly artistic rendering of African-American life and love in Chicago, complete with stepper sets, spoken word, and philosophical debates at house parties. But the most important part of Love Jones? The music.
Who am I? It's not important. But they call me brother to the night. And right now, I'm the blues in your left thigh. Trying to become the funk in your right.
From Charlie Parker to Dion Ferris, Lauryn Hill to the Lincoln Center Orchestra, woo, child! It is the music that tells this story. And storytelling is what black music does. And it so happens that June is Black Music Month, an opportunity to read those stories laid down in the tracks of black artists, both past and present.
How many of you know what month this is? Somebody said June. Right on. This is Black Music Month.
Yeah, right on, Mr. President. That's President Jimmy Carter in 1979 declaring June as Black Music Month. And for decades, black musicians, producers, songwriters, and others have shaped the musical landscape of this country and the globe. From maps to the Underground Railroad hidden in the lyrics of freedom songs. The pain baked into the blues.
I went to the crossroads, fell down on my knees.
The necessity of improvisation and collaboration, written by jazz. The struggle of the streets, narrated by hip hop.
Fight the power. We got to fight the power that beat.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and we start today with celebration and discussion of Black Music Month here on The Takeaway. And for more on this, we're joined by Nabil Ayers, writer and general manager of the record label 4AD. Nabil, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And also with us is Mark Anthony Neal, the James B. Duke Distinguished Professor of African and African American Studies at Duke University and host of the podcast Left of Black. Mark, it is so great to have you with us.
What's up, Melissa? How you doing?
Oh, it's so good to talk with you. Mark, I am going to start with you. I want to start with the origins of Black Music Month. Where did this come from?
It is Kenny Gamble. It is Deanna Williams, who's still on radio in Philadelphia, and it's Ed Wright, wanting to find a moment to take advantage of the popularity of black music, taking signals from what the country music industry had been doing. They approached President Carter, you know, can we get some sort of acknowledgement? And we heard his great words in the beginning as they all sat there on the White House lawn, having a kind of soul food picnic, if you will, listening to soul music. And, you know, for someone like Kenny Gamble and, you know, who's the founder of Philadelphia International Records with Leon Huff, it was an opportunity not only to talk about the popularity of black music, but really to double down on the idea of the black music industry as an important economic cog to black Americans in America generally, and to acknowledge its broader history of the impact of black music.
So I love that sort of place that you began with us. And I have to say, when I watched that video with President Carter, it was so high 70s. It was really fascinating to watch. But Nabil, I want to come to you because part of how we entered into this conversation, you know, on the team and wanting to talk about this today was this piece that you did for Pitch Fork, really asking what Black Music Month means now. So in talking with artists for Pitchfork, what did you find that Black Music Month means now?
It was a really interesting project because I went into it, you know, my background is that I was an intern at a record company a long time ago, and then I worked in and later owned a record store. And, you know, in the 90s and 2000s, Black Music Month really existed largely in record stores because that was where people bought music. That was really the only place. So I was very familiar with it. And now I work for a record company and I notice it every year. And I just kind of assumed that everyone knew it. But when I saw every year it's a presidential proclamation that Black Music Month exists and is celebrated, which is pretty incredible. And that started with Bill Clinton, I believe, in 2000. But when Donald Trump tweeted it last year in 2020, I was just so surprised to see that that was still a thing and that he was doing it. I mean, it's online. There's a very long letter from him that, you know, I doubt he actually wrote or even read, but it's celebrating, calling out certain artists, talking about how important Black music is in America. And so that made me really think about it and get into it. And my plan was to talk to, you know, a younger generation of artists and newer artists and artists of all ages and kind of learn what their thoughts are on Black Music Month 42 years in. But what I found is that, and this isn't true across the board, but a lot of the people I talked to, especially the younger people, just weren't familiar with it. And, you know, Deanna Williams, who I spoke to, it was clear to say that for every artist I talked to that wasn't familiar, there are many who are. And I know that's true, but it was interesting talking to these people who weren't familiar. So the piece's focus really kind of shifted to all the interesting things I learned about that artists are doing that are in the same spirit of sort of not only mobilizing the economics, but just talking about the sort of broader sense of what Black music is and getting it out there, whether or not it's officially associated with Black Music Month.
All right, so I want to go to exactly that idea. Mark, let me come back to you for a second. What is Black music?
How much time do we
have? I'm glad that you laughed. That's Mark and I know each other going back, so.
I think most people generally think of it in terms of music that's produced by Black people that's produced in what we recognize as Black musical idioms. But of course, that's complicated, right? Because Black genius is spread out in so many different genres of music. And in many cases, genres of music are people that aren't aware of, right? So we just don't know about the Black imprint, for instance, on classical music, the same way that we understand that imprint in jazz or blues and R&B and things of that nature. And then it gets a little, you know, interesting when you might have, for instance, white artists who happen to be very good at performing Black music, right, in Black idioms in ways that, you know, I think about Boz Scaggs as being a great example of this, right? There are people who might know just right now when I tell them that Boz Scaggs is white and didn't know so because he sounds as though he makes Black music.
So, okay. Let's pause here for a second because, Nabil, one of the other pieces that I found interesting in the conversations you were having with artists now is exactly kind of that point that on the one hand, there are the history that I told, sort of the freedom songs, gospel, you know, blues, jazz, we recognize those. But you were talking with artists who were in other spaces who wanted to also lay claim to that as part of the Black music tradition.
Right. I mean, you know, one of the really interesting conversations I had of many was with Angel Bot DeWeed, who's a clarinetist and composer who lives in Chicago. And right, I was on a Zoom with her and, you know, sort of to illustrate that point, she told me that she'd just been on a Zoom with 12 Black bassoonists.
And yes, 12 Black bassoonists.
It just blew my
mind.
I want
a podcast called 12 Black Bassoonists.
I know, right? It's really incredible. And she was, you know, talking a lot about how in the classical world and the composition world, there's a huge Black presence, but most people just aren't aware of it. And likewise, I mean, I learned a lot just talking to people about, of course, electronic music, where Kate Donata just was the first Black person this year to win the Dance Electronic Album Grammy and Song Grammy too, I believe, just kind of incredible. But you know, dance electronic music is a genre that is generally a byproduct of, you know, funk and house and disco and all these more traditionally Black genres. So there's definitely a lot of that happening. Rock music, of course, country music with Mickey Guyton this year. There's it definitely exists.
All right. So, but there's this other sort of maybe the we don't want to call it the dark side, the nefarious side here, Mark, which is not necessarily white artists who are performing what we might traditionally think of as black music and are widely loved and accepted by black folks, whether we know their own racial category or not. But what about the Elvises of the story of black music, those who drew from black music but did not cite black music?
I think that's another reason why Black Music Month is so history. I think of my colleague Guthrie Ranty, who describes it as a Black Music History Month, right? As an opportunity to double down on a broader history. We know from the 1950s, right? There were, you know, more than the Elvises who were involved in what we know as the cover movement, where white artists specifically would record black music and dumb it down, right? White it down, if you will. So everyone knows, you know, Elvis Presley's Hound Dog, but most folks have never heard Big Mama Thornton's original version of Hound Dog, which sounds so dramatically different and dramatically black, you know, as opposed to the Elvis record. There's so many cases, right? You know, folks will say, well, now this is a great time for folks to acknowledge the African-American impact on black music, for folks to get their recognition. But that recognition sometimes comes in the vacuum of the economic realities, that so many people were able to generate so many millions of dollars on black musical labor and black musical talent that black artists never got the opportunity to see. And that was why this was so important for Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff and Philadelphia International Records to make that particular connection between the popularity of black music and the economic role that it plays in black communities.
So, Nabil, let me come to you on that, because one of the folks you talked to said, well, black music is green.
Right. That was the, I think that was the official sort of tagline of the first Black Music Month in 1979, which, you know, was a very overt and obvious statement to, you know, that they were not trying to be subtle about saying that there is a lot of money generated by black artists playing music, and we need to acknowledge that.
And does that green, though, show up in black communities, or is it primarily enriching other folks?
That's a tougher question to answer. I mean, I know, and Mark, you probably know more about this than I do, but I know that part of the Black Music Month, the reason part of it began because they wanted to funnel more of that money back to black businesses, black owned record labels, of course, black record stores. But the is it going there question, I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer.
We heard from a caller who mentions how black music tells a story, and the song she mentions does just that.
This is Valetti Key from New Orleans. Let me tell you, the song that speaks to me the most is Life by KC and JoJo. And when you hear that song, I be thinking about all them brothers that be up in Angola. And so I think that song helps me imagine how they get to that point. You know, the song say, what happened to my master plan? It shouldn't have gone down this way. You know, black male in the family of three been robbed of my destiny. So he already felt the systemicness of racism as a black man. And that led him down a path of life. And he's sitting there wondering, tell me, how did I get life? And if that ain't a story to help you understand where these young brothers be going and headed, I don't know what is.
Listen, let me tell you, just hearing my people speak in our NOLA sound of voice reminds me of how black music infuses even the ways that we speak. And Mark, I want to come to you on this because I've been missing New Orleans because of COVID-19, a pandemic that disrupted so many things. What did it do to the music industry for black artists over the course of the past year and a half?
The music industry's dirty secret is that artists don't make a whole lot of money on the selling of their actual music. So many other people do. They make their money being on the road by touring. And the one thing that COVID did for black artists over the last year was to really hamper their ability to make a living by being out on the road. The internet became incredibly important. You know, folks who figured out ways to monetize, you know, doing performances in their living room. I love the work that Toby Enwigwe from down in Houston did over the last year in terms of creating a platform to be able to push his music out into the world without having to go on tour. Versus was so incredibly important, not so much for new music, but artists were able to double down on their catalog. I'm sure the Isley Brothers, Earth, Wind & Fire, Patti LaBelle, Gladys Knight, you know, saw incredible increases in the sales of their music, their back catalog, because of Versus, right? But, you know, once things open up again, people can make the money that they can make by being back on the road and connecting with people.
So you're so right about Versus and the ways that, from my perspective, the things that saved my life during quarantine was Club Quarantine and Versus, right? Sort of having Black music to see us through in those moments. But then this point about the green for Black artists. So Nabil, let me ask you about this a bit, because one of the things you lay out in the piece is about the Black artist database and other ways that contemporary Black artists are seeking to support the industry and support one another. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I think this is a pretty incredible story. I mean, to do a little bit of a backstory, there's Bandcamp, which is a great platform on which, you know, any musician, small to huge, can upload their album, you know, receive payment directly. Bandcamp takes a small fee. However, once the pandemic hit and Bandcamp realized so many artists weren't able to tour and make money like usual, they started waiving their fees once a month on a certain Friday each month and calling it Bandcamp Friday. So on those Fridays, they were very heavily publicized and pushed by artists, and artists were receiving, or artists or small labels, 100% of any income that came in that day. So those became a big deal. And right around that time, a woman in London who's a DJ named Nikitha Delanancy kind of realized that even though things were hard for the musicians she knew in London and Europe, that it was harder in America, where there was, you know, no real sort of fallback plan and people were having a hard time paying their rent. And she saw the Bandcamp Fridays as a real way to kind of mobilize support. So she and some other friends got together and just started a simple Google spreadsheet and started a list of Black electronic musicians. I think she said they got about 30 people that they knew and they could think of. And this was 2 days before one of the Bandcamp Fridays in June of 2020, and put that up on some Facebook pages and some groups, went to bed and woke up. They'd asked people to sort of add to it and woke up, and there were 500 names on the list, which was kind of incredible. And by Friday, the next day, there were 1,000. And this was a way for people to literally just put money directly in the pockets of those musicians by buying their music. Bandcamp pays musicians every day via PayPal, so there's no waiting, there's no monthly thing or anything like that. And it turned into a much bigger thing. I think it's at around 3,500 artists and creators and labels right now. And it was under the Instagram handle Black Bandcamp, but now it's called the Black Music Database. And this is completely volunteer run. There was no money behind it. No one was getting paid. These are just people who saw a need and acted. And it's kind of a great example of, you know, what somebody can do today that's in the spirit of Black Music Month.
In so many ways, that feels to me like the very stories of what Black music is at its core. I mean, even beyond the sonic aspects, sort of that notion of the collective, collaborative work that we do with each other, even as we're creating art. But Mark, I have to reveal this. I feel nothing has shows my age more than music taste. Like, I'm definitely that person who now mocks my children about the hip hop they listen to. So help me to think about the stories that are being told in contemporary Black music that maybe an old head like me can still really appreciate.
You know, they're telling the stories of their own lives, right? And in the world that an 18 or 19 year old experience now is very different than the world that we experienced when we were that age. Black music has always been about storytelling, right? Both the storytelling of individual artists who are making music, but also the broader stories of who we are as a community. And you know, the thing that has been ongoing about Black music, if you want to find out what's happening in Black America, listen to the wide genre styles that we define as Black music, and you will hear the story about what's going on. We know that, for instance, that, you know, young artists and young Black folks are dealing with things like addiction to painkillers, because you can't listen to a hip hop song and not hear some reference to Percocet. As just one example of that. And I think very often as older listeners, because I'm with you right there, right? I'm sitting there in the car, my 18-year-old. I'm like, what is this that we're listening to? Right? Can I put on my Billy Preston CD? Right. So right. But you know, they are articulating the world that they're in, and we have to get away from placing judgment on how they describe that world and actually go in and listen to what they're dealing with and what they're feeling at this moment.
Absolutely. Thank you so much to Mark Anthony Neal, the James B. Duke Distinguished Professor of African and African American Studies at Duke University. He's also the host of the podcast Left of Black. And to Nabil Ayers, writer and general manager of the record label 4AD. And check out Nabil's piece in Pitchfork about what Black Music Month means now. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
It's been 6 years since the NFL reached a $1 billion settlement in response to retired players connecting traumatic brain injuries suffered during play to long-term loss of cognitive function.
Well, it's something that we thought was important to do because we want to make sure that the players who may need help, may need assistance, or their families get that as soon as possible. Rather than litigating this for years and years, we have a fund that's available based on need.
Roger Goodell speaking about the settlement on CBS in 2015. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court then paved the way for the settlement in 2016, refusing to hear a challenge to a lower court's decision on the agreement. And in that settlement, the NFL did not actually admit guilt for its role in the players' brain injuries. But last week, the NFL admitted it is guilty of something else, a practice known as race norming. Now, race norming means the league determined eligibility for settlement dollars based, in part, on the race of the player. Using a decades-old medical practice, the NFL asserted that Black players typically had lower cognitive function than their white counterparts. In short, race norming made it harder for Black players to qualify for a payout if they have dementia. And now the NFL says it's reevaluating all prior claims made under the concussion settlement. In a statement put out by the league last week, a spokesperson said, quote, "Everyone agrees race-based norms should be replaced, but no off-the-shelf alternative exists, and that's why these experts are working to solve this decades-old issue."
Very insulting for that to even be going on.
Former running back and current Detroit Lions assistant head coach Deuce Staley weighed in on the news with reporters last Thursday.
Now the NFL is correcting themselves. You know, without being corrected, you still have a problem. But now I guess they're coming out and saying, okay, you know, this was wrong, this, that, and other, and they're correcting it now, which that's what you want.
But other former players are more skeptical that the NFL is ready to hold itself accountable for the racially biased practice. For more on what the recent decision made by the NFL means for Black players, I spoke with Ken Jenkins, a former Washington running back, and Mary Claire Dale, legal affairs writer for the Associated Press and 2018 Nieman Fellow at Harvard.
I think what's interesting is that it was developed in medicine, specifically in neurocognitive medicine, in the early 1990s, with the goal of really capturing more people who might need treatment. So when people take dementia tests, which often include several hours of testing under many different types of skills, memory, language, executive function, et cetera, the scores can be normed by both gender, education, and in this case, race. Again, in medicine, it was intended to offer more people treatment that might need it and whose scores may not have suggested that they had some cognitive disabilities. But here in this case, instead of looking at people holistically, they were using it to look at the scores to determine a legal award, which even medical ethicists and doctors say was never the intention of how these norms were designed to be used.
And yet, Mr. Jenkins, it's not as though the NFL looked at itself, its own practices, and was like, oh, this is terrible. We should stop. What did it take to actually bring this to light and to move this towards ending the practice?
You know, it took the efforts of the wives who actually have to manage their household and their families while they watch their husbands steadily and slowly decline, the men that they knew to be these vibrant human beings. And it took a petition of 50,000 signatures to shed light on the subject and the practice. And that's what really moved the needle. There were lawyers who actually have been working on this for 3 or 4 years and could get no movement at all. But once the public outcry got to be loud enough, they changed their story.
As a former player, And particularly, I'm thinking about your wife and the other wives and partners who, as you point out, are managing the realities of these traumatic head injuries and of the following cognitive issues that come along with it. How are y'all kind of feeling about the NFL in this moment?
Well, we understand that the NFL owns Sunday, and the NFL is mega powerful, smart lawyers, expensive lawyers. And we realize that we're David and Goliath here, us being David, obviously. And so we feel like we've gotten some wins here with the NFL disbanding the race norming algorithm. And they've also decided, you know, they're going to go back and retroactively look at all the players who may have been race normed. That's a win. But overall, you know, we just don't trust them because they're the ones who, you know, they were the architects of this side door that allowed them to get away with it for so long. So the proof is in the pudding. If they do this, that's great. My concern is that there'll be another side door because they are slick and smart. And to this point, Chris Seeger, who was supposed to be our representative, has been overpowered by the NFL.
So Mary Claire, let me come to you on exactly that, that feeling of being over, or that reality of being overpowered by the NFL. Some were saying this even before the race norming became public, about the idea of the $1 billion settlement in and of itself, that $1 billion sounds like a lot, but relative to what is made in the NFL, that it's actually kind of small potatoes. Is this settlement big enough?
Well, right now the settlement is uncapped. So that in some ways is what's led to this issue, I think, of the NFL appealing awards if they were not, quote, fully demographically normed, which means if they were not race normed. The settlement came about in 2013 through secret negotiations after hundreds of lawsuits had been filed against the NFL by former players who accused the NFL basically of fraud and said that they had hidden what they knew about the effect of repeated concussions and send people back out on the field. So rather than go to trial, it was a risk for players as well. So the two sides forged a settlement, which initially was capped at $765 million. The judge fairly quickly, within I believe a year or two by 2015, had realized that that was not going to be enough. And she really, you know, I think forced the NFL to uncap it. The NFL, of course, is footing the bill for the award fund. But because of that, the NFL started to become much more aggressive, appealing awards more frequently. And really, when only about 28% of the dementia claims were being leading to an award, and these are claims which doctors had determined that the person had a certain level of dementia, and yet 70% of the time they were being rejected, that is when I believe the lawyers started to look more closely at how they were scored. And I think to their surprise, realized that this race norming was occurring.
So, Mary Claire, are you saying the physicians were not aware that the race norming practice was happening?
I think they are. I think that it's actually up to them to do it. And again, the idea, I think physicians most often want to look holistically at a patient and, you know, bring in their education. In other words, is this what they're seeing, you know, representative of who the person was? What's interesting about this case is that I think Ken and others would argue, you know, correctly, that the NFL players, black, white, or other races, have more in common with each other than not, because most of them had 3 years of college. They may come from more similar than dissimilar backgrounds in some cases. But, you know, the whole thing was meant to be a crude proxy for socioeconomic levels. But here you have a group of men who have a more similar background, again, than not.
Mary Claire, that is so helpful, that reminder that race is a social construct. It's not norming based on blood type or some other kind of physiological reality. And in this case, right, there's every reason to think that the social grouping here is more relevant than any of the divides around race. So, Ken, I want to come back to you on this a bit, because the NFL is claiming that it's going to go back, review old claims. Do you think that's enough? Or are you and other retired players and families looking for something more?
Well, we think that's a step in the right direction. We are looking for more. We want, and I feel like if they don't provide us with all the demographic information of all the people who've been through the regimen of and all the testing, to reveal what the true facts and the true numbers are, then we haven't really illuminated what they have done. And I believe if that information was in the NFL's favor, they would have released that information already. The NFL and their lawyers, their job is to reduce the exposure in the suit. I'm in the insurance industry. I work with big corporations as much as I can. And it's always a fight between the client and the insurance companies as to what they're going to cover. And if there is a side door somewhere, the insurance companies will exercise it. And given that the NFL, with Chris Seeger's capitulence, has put us in a terrible situation where we can't trust what they come up with at this point.
When you talk about that side door, those multiple side doors, the lack of trust, I'm wondering if any of that is deterring young people and maybe their families from entering the league.
Well, so it's really interesting. I talked to some, you know, very high powered folks at both the NFL and the NFLPA, and not to name names, but they say, you know, as long as they're poor folks, they're going to be kids playing football.
They call you all gladiators for a reason, right? That same idea of sort of how it works for the public entertainment.
Yes, yes. And we know it's a, you know, an extremely, you know, violent game. But you know, we know more about concussions now than we knew back when I played, and certainly prior to that in the 70s and 60s. So the concussion protocols are better. I worry now that they're going to make it more difficult for all players to qualify under the suit, leaving them another side door. It's with this case not being transparent, and I think Mary Claire can speak to, there will be more transparency, but with the way that the agreements were done prior to this, there was no transparency. So we don't really know what's being discussed.
So that transparency question, let me come to you, Mary Claire, because that's precisely what media, what reporting, what social movements are meant to do, is to bring some level of transparency to practices like this. What will you be keeping your eyes on as, you know, you hear Ken here sort of talking about the fear of another side door? How do you see your role in terms of reporting on this to move towards practices of equity?
Right. Well, very interestingly, the players filed this suit in 2020 after their attempts to do it through the administrative process. Basically, the award fund had failed. And the judge dismissed the suit this year on procedural grounds. But again, amongst the action and petition drive and publicity that people like Ken and his wife have taken part in, the judge, in a very, very unusual way, after dismissing the suit, decided that it was very important and asked a magistrate to compile a report on it. And that report is now due this Friday. And that was sort of a new development. Initially, there was not a deadline for that report. And we are very much hoping Ken and others and the lawyers for the more of the Black players really want to see the data, the payout data by race, and see how often, what's the percentage of successful claims by Black players and versus white. And again, the NFL is now pledging to review those and correct anything that where a player did not get an award that he would have had he been white. But again, they will be fighting these claims probably because it's dollars and it's also reputational damage. But one note on that, if this settlement is likely to go beyond about $1 billion, they've paid out about $800 million so far. But, to put that in perspective, I believe the NFL just signed their latest multi-year TV contract for $113 billion. So the players would, I think, argue that they have the money to write the very serious brain injuries that people are suffering from.
And I am going to leave it on that idea of $113 billion television contract and a $1 billion settlement for the players. Mary Claire Dale, legal affairs writer for the Associated Press and a former Nieman Fellow, and Ken Jenkins, a former Washington running back. Thank you both so much for talking with us through this.
Thank you.
It's been great to be with you. Thank you.
Before I let Ken go, I did have to ask him to weigh in on another NFL-related matter. what to rename his former team, which is currently just going by the Washington Football Team.
That's really funny. I actually like the Red Wolves. If you could imagine sort of 70,000 people as the team comes on the field howling like a wolf.
I get that. I like that. Yeah.
I like the Red Wolves. I do.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega. In Minnesota, Native American activists and protesters have gathered to stop construction of the Line 3 pipeline by Enbridge, a Canadian-based company. According to the New York Times, the pipeline would carry oil from Canada to Wisconsin through tribal lands and watersheds, where critics are worried leaks or spills could taint rivers and damage the environment. This project would replace and expand an older pipeline and move hundreds of thousands of barrels of oil every day. President Biden has positioned himself as a defender of the environment, so many are watching to see how his administration will respond to the Line 3 pipeline protests and the calls to protect the environment. With me now is Marionette Pember, national correspondent for Indian Country Today and a citizen of the Red Cliff Band of Wisconsin Ojibwe. Mary, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hi, good to be here.
Mary, you were just in Minnesota and you were covering the Line 3 pipeline protests. Talk to me about what protesters are hoping to accomplish.
The water protectors, I think they're hoping to stop Line 3 at this point. It's 60, according to Enbridge, it's 60% finished. So that would, you know, at this point, I think it would require a presidential action, or there are some lawsuits ongoing right now. I think basically, you know, they're wanting to do anything that they can to stop the pipeline construction.
So the water protectors have really been at the forefront of this work now for at least in public media for quite some time. Can you walk us through what protesters and members of Indigenous communities are worried about when it comes to the construction and use of this particular pipeline?
Well, there's always potentially a leak. The pipeline, Enbridge has framed it as a quote-unquote replacement based on safety issues, that the existing pipeline is old and corroding. However, this is actually a new pipeline. This is there was a project that they tried to do similar called the Sandpiper Pipeline. What they're creating is a pipeline that's a larger gauge, greater circumference, so that it could carry tar sands oil. So I think that, they have proven themselves really masterful at creating, public narrative and framing things in ways that are more favorable to them. So tar sands oil is especially difficult to clean up. I don't know if you may recall that there was a spill in Michigan back in 2010 a great deal of pipeline, this tar sands oil was spilled and really had a devastating impact on the environment. So the greatest concern for Native people is, of course, the pipeline potential for accidents going through their ceded treaty territories on which they have rights to hunt, fish, and gather. And it would endanger the environment. And I think also both the Native people and non-Native people are concerned about the longer term implications of spending a great deal of money on this on infrastructure that's based on long-term vision and usage of fossil fuels. And the money would be better spent on using some sort of and furthering some sort of sustainable energy sources.
So can you talk to me a little bit about the Biden administration response or lack of response to these protests?
Well, yeah, there's been pretty much a lack of response. I think it's rather difficult for him. You know, he has, I think, a great deal of, you know, ties to labor. And I think perhaps based on that, that has maybe underscored his reluctance to act.
Can you say a little bit more about that relative to the ties to labor? Because I have seen some of the Enbridge responses saying, well, we've hired companies that, you know, that are owned by Indigenous folks, and we're, you know, we're hiring workers who are Indigenous folks. And so it does feel like they're making a claim to sort of a transaction between labor jobs and environmental security.
Yes, they have been really masterful at forwarding, you know, those claims. They actually have created an Indigenous people's policy, they're calling it, in which they say that they support United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which was adopted in 2007. And the first element of the declaration is to receive that corporations or any sort of project should receive free prior informed consent before they go forward. And they say that they support it, but then in the same document, they say, well, it's not legally binding. So I guess they just say it, but they don't do it, which is kind of a striking thing. And they have hired some Native people. And that's the thing I think is very important about this project. You know, Native people are not a monolithic group, just like every other, you know, community and population. Some people are, you know, support things, some people don't. And they have done, Enbridge has done a very good job, I think, of exploiting those differences. There's a great need of jobs in the area, and of course, you know, exacerbated by the pandemic. And some people have been forced into a corner and have taken these jobs, even though I think there are some Native people who do work for Enbridge, either in a direct capacity or as contractors. You don't really see a whole lot of people that are, you know, really on their bully pulpit supporting the pipeline. It's imbued with a lot of ambivalence. Many people feel that they don't have any choice. And I think it's not just the Native people. I think it's the people, the community in general along the pipeline route in northern Minnesota. There aren't a great deal of jobs. I mean, this is in the north. People rely on tourism. And people feel as though, you know, they really don't have a lot of choice. So it's rather a complex issue.
Indeed. And I absolutely understand the points that you're making, having lived in Louisiana along those fence line communities where folks are working for oil companies, because that's what the work is, at the same time that they are acknowledging the health consequences for living in those communities, right, from those polluters. So it's a long-term and a multi-pronged, and as you said, complex issue. So talk to me about what the protesters have so far been able to achieve.
Well, you know, it hasn't just been quote unquote protesters, and we prefer to actually call them water protectors. People have been opposing this pipeline for years and been going through all of the entire legal process, and now are sort of at the, you know, we're down to the wire. People are, you know, actively putting their bodies on the line. So I think that, you know, they're at this point where they feel like, you know, this is at this point, there's really kind of nothing to lose.
Marionette Pember is a national correspondent for Indian Country Today and a citizen of the Red Cliff Band of Wisconsin Ojibwe. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Good to be here.
Okay, y'all, that's all we have for you today. And we really appreciate you spending your time with us and today just jamming a little bit. We really enjoy hearing your voices on the show, so please keep calling in if you want to tell us more of your touching stories or if you want to call us with some show ideas. You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.